The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley@admworld.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 21st day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. We'll hear about the agricultural news from Dave Dickey, your director of agricultural programming. The folks at the Andersons from right here in Champaign County will be along to discuss the agricultural cash grain market at the bottom of the half hour, about 26 minutes away. We'll take up the agricultural weather forecast with the Chesapeake Energy meteorologist. And in the second half hour of the program, we call that the Farming World. And you can always hear it online at willag.org if your radio station doesn't carry it. We'll discuss cellulosic ethanol. Have you wondered what happened to it? Whether it's a viable option and when it might come about? We'll have some answers with the folks at Blue Fire Ethanol. And it's all right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Here's the way the numbers settled up on Monday afternoon in Chicago for the July nearby soft red winter wheat, a settlement price at $4.62. Up a quarter of a cent today. September at 4.77 and a quarter, a penny and a half, or rather just a half cent lower. It was December futures that were down a penny and a half at 5.07 and a quarter. Hard red winter wheat, July contract at 4.99 and three quarters, two and a half higher that in Kansas City. Back in Chicago, July corn, 3.55, down five and three quarters. September at 3.64 and a quarter, down five and three quarters. And December futures at 374 and three quarters, down five and three quarters. March contract in the corn pit at 387 and a half, 6 cents lower. The May futures at 396 and a quarter, down six and a quarter. From the soy complex, July beans at 963 and a quarter, up two and a quarter. August at 956 and three quarters, up five and three quarters. September at 944, up six and a quarter. And November beans at 939, 8.5 cents higher. January up 8 and a quarter at $9.48. Live cattle, 82.5 cents higher. Lean hogs up $1.12.5. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Let's recap some of those numbers from Chicago CME Group livestock side. June live cattle futures 82.5 higher at $90.12.5. August at 89.32.5, $1.12.5 higher. August feeders at 111.70, up $1.52.5. September's at 111.45, up $1.45. And July lean hogs at $82 even, up $1.12.5 on this Monday afternoon. Crude oil futures, July contract at $77.69, up 51 cents for the day. Natural gas at $4.88.5, down 11 and two-tenths of a cent. Ethanol futures at $1.60 and 3 cents, up 2 and a tenth of a cent. And the gold futures, June contract at $1,239.70, finished $17.50 lower. Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,481, just about 32 points higher. And the U.S. dollar for the day at 85.93 is up 0.23 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather looks like across the Midwest. Hot weather will occur today, right on through Tuesday. Highs in the upper 80s and 90s. A few extremes near 100 may occur Tuesday. Some cooler air will gradually work its way from northwest to the southeast across the Midwest Wednesday into Friday, and showers and thunderstorms will continue periodically from Nebraska to northern Ohio and Michigan this week, while net drying occurs from Missouri into the lower Ohio River Valley. A high pressure ridge is advertised for next week. That could be a threat, but World Weather Incorporated believes its position will be a little too far to the west to cause a serious problem. Temperatures will be warm, but periodic showers and thunderstorms will occur to slow the dryness and the process of drying out. Crop conditions should stay good for the next 10 days or so. More on the weather when we get to the bottom of the hour here on the Closing Market Report. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. On the phone line with us to take a look at what happened in the world markets and the futures is Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, let's start with the world markets, because I suppose the yuan was the big news out of China. They said, hey, let's let her float just a bit. What happened?
Yeah, they pretty well made it official, but if you turn the recorder to reverse and replay a few months ago, this is anticipated, the timing of the issue. There was a lot of speculation. It happened around June the 10th time window, but 11 days later, or 10 days later, here it happens. But that makes their purchasing power a lot more better to buy foreign products. It hurts their export market, though. Makes their products a little bit more expensive on the world market, per se. But that gave the market broad market support in general, so we had just about all the markets higher overnight into the early trade. But as we developed the trade here in the U.S. market, quite a bit of the enthusiasm fell victim to profit-taking and some liquidation there, Todd.
Tell me about the marketplace around you and what you hear from producers as they look out on their crops.
As you look at the crop, that'd be addressed here this afternoon at 3 o'clock on the crop conditions report. And basically, the ones we're visiting with is deterioration. There's been a lot of moisture across the upper Midwest, and that has kept the low areas in a bad situation where they've been unable to get that crop going, for say, nitrogen. Being lost in some areas, and the poor areas are starting to stick out like a sore thumb, and that could probably be addressed here today as the crop condition report is a visual observation. Then the other thing is there's no real crop to observe in some areas. We talked to a ton of producers, I mean a couple thousands, and we're seeing a situation where a good portion of those producers don't have all their beans in, and up to a handful that I know of don't have it being one in the ground. So we could start seeing maybe loss of some bean acres. We'll see how the weather unfolds here over the next week or two. I know the 6 to 10 day and 8 to 14 day shows above normal temperature and below normal precips, and there might be a chance to get those beans in the ground, but they're going to be late, and they're going to be fighting not only the environment, but also the clock time-wise, too, Todd.
Now, I was talking to some folks in the Mason County area. That's over in the Havana region.
Yeah.
They're in bad shape, really bad shape, apparently, over there. The Muhammad Aquifer, which runs under here in Champaign County, but is it's underneath us here. It's up on the top there, and so they have a lot of rain. They're on the Illinois River, and they didn't get the crops in, and there is a lot left to be planted in that area, I suppose. And while it's just one area, it might be indicative of some of the problems that producers face, and that eventually we'll hear about as this crop begins to go through the process of maturing later in the season.
Yeah, the June acreage report's not going to address it. They're going to have to resurvey again. We won't know until January, but we've got guys out in Nebraska. Same situation. It's worse out there. And, we'll see how they address it. That could change the whole fundamental picture on beans. I know I was quite bearish all winter long looking for bean acres. There's big bean acre potential there, but that's slowly going out the window.
Can you turn friendlier to the corn market? It's had a pretty good rally.
It did what it needed to do. Beans got up to 945 objective. We got to 947 and a quarter today. Corn got up to 387 there last night. Objective was 385, so we had a good up. I didn't like the close today. We had bullish news, started higher and ended up day lower, failing to close the upper end of the range. Technically, and failing to close the upper end of the range on bullish news, so we're probably due to back and fill here. But overall, it's encouraging. This is our summer rally to get stuff priced. So we got to use this strength to get caught up, because as we move along in here, if weather does turn a little favorable, it's going to be awful hard for the market to go sharply higher unless it turns hot and dry. The only way to bring public in is their yard's turning brown, and that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Turn your attention back to the Chinese currency. How long do you think it'll take before it really strengthens, and does that mean that we'll have purchases, soybean purchases in the fall?
Well, this is sort of a stair-step process. They let their currency appreciate, and then they, keep it stable. They're not letting it float freely, per se, and be subject to like our currency is in the world marketplace yet. So that would be the big thing if that ever happened. That'd be extremely bullish. Commodities, per se. They like to control stuff, and they're going to continue to control the situation. The other thing on the corn I failed to mention was related to China, and there's rumors that one of the cargoes was rejected. Now, there's no confirmation on that, but that's probably got the run in the corn market we saw up and that type of rumor floating around, that got the market on edge. But no, they're going to buy grain whether they had a strong currency or a weak currency. Either way, they're going to be buyers. They need grain, and they're buying it. And, unless their crop conditions turn to a more cooler, wetter pattern, unless their demand slows down, they'll continue to be in the marketplace. They even bought 120,000 tons of old beans here over the weekend. Now, whether that switched to new beans or not, we'll see. But they're going to continue to be a buyer. It's just how big of a buyer.
Any advice for the livestock producer?
Well, we've got the big run-up we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
The key is take advantage of it. So any types of ups in here, we like to, if you can do something with the packer or else, do something here on the board. I think you got to be locking in these higher values here. We got small numbers and increase in demand, so this is good it's going to get. Hopefully it'll last here for another year. But, two, if we would have one more push to the downside in the grain market, I'd look at locking in some feed needs here, some lower levels, too.
All right. Thanks so much.
Very good, Todd. Thanks.
Uh-huh. That's Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And the Closing Market Report, is funded in part by you, and it's a cooperative effort between the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, University of Illinois Extension, and Illinois Public Media, and you, the listener. And we need you to step up now by the end of the year. That's June 30th. If you can visit willpledge.org and pledge your financial support, we would surely appreciate it. We hope that the Closing Market Report is important enough to you and makes a difference in the way you market that you'd be willing to, step up and pledge a little financial support at willpledge.org. Do it by the 30th. Of June. Dave Dickey is here now. He'll help us take a complete look at the agricultural newscast.
In agricultural news, Japan says it plans to loosen its grip on food wheat imports from the United States, Australia, and Canada by giving trading houses flexibility in handling logistics for bulk imports starting from September loading. The move, initially aimed at cutting administrative costs, is likely to result in lower sale prices to flour millers and thus benefit consumers. Japan, the world's fourth biggest wheat importer, is also considering importing milling wheat from Ukraine, Russia, Argentina, and Germany in a bid to diversify its sources of wheat. USDA has proposed a new antitrust rule that would prohibit meat packers from showing preferences to big feedlots rather than buying from small producers, and that would also make it easier for farmers to file suits under the Packers and Stockyards Act. Among other steps, the rule would bar meat packers from offering better prices to large feeders and smaller operators without good reason and give poultry producers more leverage in dealing with integrators who dominate the business. The rule is scheduled to appear in the Federal Register on Tuesday to open a 30-day comment period that is one of the last steps to issuing a new regulation. Governments moved closer on Friday to curbing the use of chemicals commonly used as coolants in refrigerators, air conditioners, hairspray, and other household items in what some say would be among their biggest climate decisions ever. The obscure round of UN ozone treaty talks in Geneva laid the groundwork this week for a possible decision in Uganda in November to halt the promotion of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico gave the talks a boost in petitioning to amend the ozone treaty, known as the 1987 Montreal Protocol, to drastically cut production and use of HFCs. If left unchecked, by 2050, scientists predict HFCs could account for 20% of the world's greenhouse gases. Internal company documents released by the government today show that BP's own worst-case scenario rate for the Gulf of Mexico oil spill could be about 100,000 barrels of oil per day. A BP spokesperson said the document is genuine, but the worst-case scenario applied only to a situation in which a key piece of equipment called a blowout preventer is removed. The internal BP document, which is undated, was released by U.S. Representative Ed Markey, chairman of a subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. Don't forget, in the second half hour of our program today, online at willag.org if you can't hear it on your radio station, we'll talk with Arnie Klon. He's with Blue Fire Ethanol, and they expect to produce cellulosic ethanol in large quantities in the near future. We'll hear more about cellulosic ethanol during the second half hour of our program today. Now up next, you know the demand curve for soybeans has shifted to the right. Well, at least we think it has. I'll have more on what that might mean. The demand curve is the graph depicting the relationship between the price of a certain commodity, in this case soybean, and the amount of it consumers are willing and able to purchase at a given price. When you put it with the supply curve, it looks something like an X, and where they cross is price. Now, if you take the demand curve and move it to the right, or add new demand, for instance, China's soybean buying spree, then the price of a commodity goes higher. The question is whether or not that new demand is temporary or permanent. A University of Illinois ag economist, Darrell Good, says at the moment, if nothing else, the Chinese soybean purchases have shifted the demand curve to the right.
I think it has. It's done two things. I think it's shifted the overall demand curve, saying in the past you think of demand as demand for consumption. Now if you have demand for inventory as well, that does shift the demand curve, saying at a given price the market is taking more soybeans than they have in the past. That's by definition a shift in demand. Secondly, is that there seems to be a seasonal shift that not only is China taking more soybeans, but it appears that they're taking them much earlier in our marketing year than they have in the past. If you just compare 09 to 08, first quarter, we've sold more than double the amount of soybeans to China that we did a year ago. So one of the interesting things that's going to unfold over the next few months is how front-loaded was the export demand this year. We know we can't maintain this pace, but how rapidly and when will the pace drop off, I think, is yet to be seen.
Interestingly enough, Darrell Good says the new demand for soybeans from China is conceptually the same as the new demand for corn from the U.S. ethanol industry. That is to say, the historic corn-to-soybean ratio remains the same because the new demand for each commodity appears to have increased by roughly the same percentage, and so the price has shifted to the right or higher. However, that is not the case for wheat, and it now is closer to the price of corn than usual. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You are listening to the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Just one quick note on that past story there with Darryl Good. That was recorded earlier in the year and kind of a reminder of where we were with the soybean exports. And they, of course, have fallen off since that point. But the question is, will they front load again in the fall, and does moving yuan around help that happen? So we'll find that out as, time passes here, and whether or not the soybean market can actually keep move to the right on the demand curve. Now let's take a look at what's been happening in the world of the cash grain market. The folks at the Anderson should be on the line with us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
And who have I had with
you? This is Carolyn.
Oh, hi, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Oh, very good. Carolyn White at the Andersons with us. Tell me about the cash grain market in the Champaign County and eastern Illinois area, please.
Well, we saw the open here, kind of exciting, following the night session to start off with, but it didn't take long and things ended up going south. Probably, as you said, disappointing exports, and evidently there was a boat that had arrived in China, and there were problems about quarantine issues cropping up at the last minute. But I think that's kind of normal. I don't know if that will remain to be seen. But cash corn here at the Andersons for June and July, we are 345. That was down 6. New crop corn down 5 at 345. Soybeans up 2 nearby. For June, we're 968, July 963, and new crop beans up 9 at 904.
Carolyn, when we talked to your counterpart at the Andersons in the Delphi location last Wednesday, they were a bit surprised and that they had so much movement of old crop corn, and that was up, of course, on that move higher in the corn market. Did you do the same thing here in Champaign County?
Yes, and I think that as we get these little rallies in corn, I think there's still a lot of old crop corn out there anyway, and I think on these rallies, guys ought to be getting it sold and also then, you know, looking at new crop if they don't have anything on, certainly.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn White is with the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Somebody from that office joins us each and every Monday afternoon on the Closing Market Report. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, China's yuan surged today by the most of any day since its landmark revaluation in 2005, sending a clear signal ahead of this weekend's G20 summit that Beijing is keeping to its word and allowing greater currency flexibility. The central bank has maintained a de facto peg since the middle of 2008. Saturday, the People's Bank of China made a surprise announcement that it would allow more flexibility for the yuan. Today, the central bank let the currency rise by 0.42% to 6.7976 per dollar. Meanwhile, China's state-run newspaper today signaled caution in regarding further moves to the upside in the yuan, saying that it would float both up and down against the dollar and that one-way appreciation was not the thrust of the reform. H.J. Heinz Company says it has agreed to buy a Chinese food company that makes soy sauces and fermented bean curd for $165 million. Today's deal for Food Star would give the U.S. ketchup maker a bigger foothold in China, boosting sales in that region by $300 million a year. And Barnes & Noble is offering a lower-price Nook electronic reader with a Wi-Fi connection, and it's cutting the price on the original Nook reader. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on the phone line with us this afternoon. Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Yesterday at church, I had a farmer come up and say, Todd, you know all the right people. Can you get them to shut off the rainfall? So the question is, can you do it?
Well, we think we can provide some helpful information to that point, Todd, although we will need some patience here, as it appears that the active pattern will still persist over the next few days, basically from now through Wednesday and wrapping up early Thursday across the eastern Corn Belt. But it looks like as we get beyond the next 4 days or so, the pattern will turn less active across much of the Midwest, especially the areas that have just been inundated here with rainfall over the past couple of weeks. And the main reason for that is that because the ridge of high pressure, which has been aligned and been a feature primarily across the southern U.S., is going to begin pushing northward. So as a result, that will begin to suppress rainfall, which is needed here for the very wet areas of the Midwest.
Now, there are some producers in the middle part of the state of Illinois near Havana that sat atop the Mahomet Aquifer. They have not been able to get much in the ground, and what they've got in the ground, at least at this point, is covered up with water, a lot of it. And they're suggesting that this year for them looks a whole lot like 1993. Have you been able to do any comparisons to rainfall amounts from that time period to this time period?
Yeah, there are some similarities here between this year and 1993. I guess depending on what area of the Midwest, or you can do some various comparisons for portions of western Illinois and southern areas of Wisconsin. Southern areas of Iowa. There are some very similarities with totals here, although the widespread nature back in 93 just encompassed more of Minnesota, the Dakotas, Nebraska, and much of overall the central and western Corn Belt was affected by the heavy rainfall and floods this year, that year compared to this year. But overall here, some similarities. From an atmospheric standpoint, you have also some similarities, but it hasn't been, an exact match here. Already, by this time of year in 1993, you had a severe drought that was developed already in place across the southeast. This year, you've certainly trended drier across parts of the southern U.S., but you don't have as severe of a drought in the southern sections of the country. But you had more severe back in 93 versus this year, Todd.
All right. And then take a look at the rest of the world. Talk to me about China and their growing regions.
Yeah, well, China has trended drier recently, but then saw some rainfall last week to help stabilize things. But that's turning around here. We're seeing hot and dry weather return to much of eastern China. That looks to persist for about 9 days. Really, the next opportunity for rainfall is going to be after that. So we have to wait another 9-10 days before that rainfall opportunity. So that's something that needs to be watched, Todd.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Mark Russo is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us from the 23rd floor of the Boeing building. That wraps up this edition of the Closing Mark Report. Stay with us if you can for the farming world, or listen online at willag.org.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois.
Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're going to talk with the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol. His name is Arnie Klon. Mr. Klon, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us about Blue Fire Ethanol. What makes it different than other types of ethanol plants?
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show, Todd. Blue Fire Ethanol is a cellulosic to ethanol type of company. Our technology makes us uniquely different in that we take a whole different approach to converting the cellulosic materials, breaking it down to its constituent components of sugar and lignin, and then producing that ethanol. And we do this by utilizing concentrated sulfuric acid. Basically, we decrystallize the sugar from the substrate lignin by using that acid as opposed to using, say, an enzymatic approach or, you know, some combination of enzymes and acids. And the reason why we do this has been proven, and when I say proven, we have over 10 years of operating experience in two different pilot plants here in Orange County, California, as well as we licensed the technology back in 2000 to a Japanese company called JGC Corporation, and JGC built a duplicate of our pilot plant in Japan, as well as a much larger pre-commercial scale plant that operated for over 4.5 years, converting wood waste, some agricultural residues, and other biomass products, breaking it down from its into its basic sugars into ethanol for the Japanese marketplace to demonstrate the efficacy of cellulosic ethanol. So we have a lot of runtime on our technology by various companies, not just ourselves, and we also have probably the highest yield that can be recovered from any type of biomass materials, whether it's the corn stover or, you know, agricultural crop residues or purpose-grown crops. So our technology is probably the most proven that is out there right now, and we achieve a very high rate of yield based on our technology.
You're one of just, I think, four companies maybe that the U.S. Department of Energy has awarded grants to construct commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol production facilities. Are you in the process of doing that?
Yes, we are, and we were one of four that did receive grants. We received $88 million from the USDA, primarily for a project that's located in Fulton, Mississippi. And that particular project, it's through its licensing phase. We've already kicked off engineering. We're getting ready to break ground this year, probably at the latest in September, doing the actual construction of the project. It's about a 19 million gallon a year ethanol plant, but it's going to be primarily processing wood waste and wood slash out of the forest. There's a tremendous amount of wood that's grown, for the paper industry and that in the northern part of Mississippi where this plant's located. And so we're going to be taking all the off-spec woods and lumbers, and also we're going to be looking at agricultural residues. There's a lot of cotton grown down there and cotton stalks, and the seeds in that will be ideal, if you will, opportunistic feedstocks for us to convert that into ethanol also.
Now, much of our audience will be familiar with corn-based ethanol. How does cellulosic-based ethanol differ? And I understand you've got a way that you're doing this, but how does the plant itself differ in producing ethanol?
Well, it's pretty much the same, except the significant difference is in the front end, where with corn, clearly you're bringing the corn kernels in and then using either a wet mill or dry mill process to break it down to where you can get the starches out, and then those starches through enzymatic process go into a sugar that eventually gets fermented. In our case, what we have to do is we have to release the sugar molecules that basically are part of the cell structure in the agricultural residues. So instead of us bringing corn in, we would take the corn cob, we would take the stover, we would take, you know, the remaining portion of the plant that otherwise cannot be utilized for a food product or converting it into ethanol. We take that material in, and what we have to do is we have to, again, decrystallize or basically decompose the material in such a fashion that the C5 and C6 sugars that make up the vast majority of the plant are released from the glue that holds those sugars together, which is called lignin. And we do this, again, through a sulfuric acid process. And that's where the complexity is, not from a technical standpoint, but it takes several more steps than what you would have in a typical corn-based plant. So what we do is we initially get the material in, we size it, we grind it to a particular size, and then we spray sulfuric acid on it. And when I say spray, this is not really what you would consider a wet process by any stretch of the imagination. It's just enough sulfuric acid to wet the surface of the biomass material. Then we mechanically, if you will, blend that such that the overall surface and the material itself is coated with the sulfuric acid. At that point, we do add water. And it goes into about a 40-minute decrystallization phase before we take that material. We put it through what's called a filter press, which basically squeezes it, and that takes the liquids out. We wash that filter media several times to make sure all the sugars are extracted. And what's left over from the filter press is the lignin itself, which is now just pure lignin. It's a carbon form. We burn that in our boilers to generate our steam and electricity for the plant, and we're 100% in balance, energy balance at that point for the amount of steam and electricity we can generate what's needed to process, you know, through the whole plant. And then the liquid stream that's left over is actually composed of the acid and the sugars. We pioneered a methodology for separating the sugars from the acid, and we achieve about a 99% separation of the sugars from the acids. We reuse and recycle the acids in the process, so we have a closed system from that standpoint. The sugars at that point are aseptic, and they are also fairly acidic. We adjust the pH, and then we put in, and then we go into very conventional sugar to ethanol fermentation. So really where we match up with the corn plants is when you're in the fermentation stage. We finally get to that point where you could utilize our technology and use those sugars to go into, say, a conventional grain-based ethanol plant to produce the ethanol.
Is it competitive with pricing for ethanol? Does the lower price, and I'm going to assume the lower price of the stover or the cellulosic feedstock, make the pilot plant and the production facility close to the pricing for ethanol on the market at this point? Can you make it break even or make money?
Well, you definitely can get in parity with the corn-based ethanol at a certain size of facility. Every company has a different break-even point, though, because, you know, bear in mind, we are one of maybe 10 different types of technologies out there that can do this conversion of the cellulose, you know, or the basic feedstock, the conversion of that corn stover into the ethanol. In our case, we are competitive down to about a 4 million gallon a year ethanol plant. We can produce ethanol and still make money at that small scale. The pilot plants, to my knowledge, no one's pilot plant can make any money because it's just the scaling factors and yield versus the amount of manpower. We target in over our 10 years of operation in that, it would appear that we can be better than corn-based ethanol at about that 19 million gallon a year size plant, the one that we're doing in Mississippi. Our cost of production at our 4 million gallon a year ethanol facility that's going to be built in Lancaster, California, which, by the way, uses the residues, organic residues that we put into our landfills. This plant is located adjacent to an existing landfill, and we're going to be taking that woody biomass and paper waste and other organic fraction, converting that into ethanol. That can be competitive in the essence of being able to make money, but not on a pricing basis for the ethanol. The ethanol production cost is much higher in that smaller scale than, say, a conventional corn-based ethanol plant is.
How much water do you use? More than a conventional ethanol plant or less?
Actually less, mainly because a lot of water comes in with the feedstock, and so we're in a position where we have to dry the feedstock that is coming in, and we use the exhaust gases from our boilers to dry that feedstock because we want that moisture content to be 10% or lower before we go into the decrystallization phase. And so there's a way of capturing that water that you're boiling off. We'll be doing that in our project in Mississippi. And so the water usage is in fact, lower than what you would have in a conventional grain-based ethanol plant.
It sounds to me as if the production facilities are pretty close to right, and that you can make that work. Where's the bottleneck, if anything, and what size facility do you think works well? I know you're talking 19 million gallons. Ethanol production facilities are much larger. Most of them that are sited now are at least 100 and probably closer to 250 million gallons a year. Is the bottleneck and the problem collection of the input stock, and does that keep sizes small in terms of the facility, do you think?
Absolutely. And that is truly the bottleneck I see that a lot of our competitors are struggling with also. It really gets into what's called the energy density unit. If you think about the corn itself, you know, you have kernels, they have cars that can move those kernels into a plant. The corn, while it's a bulk commodity, has a very high energy content per the small kernel, and it packs well. When you think about harvesting, though, a rice straw or a wheat straw or a corn stover, it's pretty bulky, but there's a lot of air that surrounds it, even if you're trying to compact it into a bale or however you're doing the corn stover. And so consequently, what you have is has very low energy content per unit volume. And so what limits you is, first of all, the bulk material that you have to move around to get it into the plant. It's much higher bulk than what you would have, say, with corn. But secondarily, as you're well aware, you can store corn because you get it down to a smaller size. You have corn, storage silos all over the country. In the case of biomass materials, you don't have that storage capability in terms of designated areas to store it or process it or whatever. And you have a very narrow window in which you're trying to harvest this residue out of the fields. Or even if you have a purpose-grown energy crop, you have to get that out of the fields and then find some place to store it so the plant can operate it on a year-round basis. And so what ends up happening with these constraints right now, and here's maybe the third constraint, is a lot of, in many, many cases, the equipment does not exist right now to harvest efficiently these agricultural residues because we normally in the past haven't done that. So consequently, you have to have new equipment that's only going to be used for a very short period of time through in the year, specifically for harvesting that type of biomass. Then you have to find some place to store it off-site because you're looking at hundreds of acres of storage requirements for, say, feeding even a 20 million gallon a year ethanol plant. So that's another issue. And then thirdly, it's the cost of bringing that material from the field to the plant. And so typically what we're looking at and what we've experienced, because we will be doing agricultural residues as well as purpose-grown crops plants in the future. As a matter of fact, we're looking at two of them right now. One of them is a rice straw ethanol plant that we worked on many, many years ago up in Sacramento. You're limited to a gathering radius of about 50 miles before your transportation costs, your storage issues, and all that overrun the ability of the plant to economically pay for that particular feedstock. So consequently, when you look at it, you're in a very bad situation, from a unit volume, again, energy density side. And so you're probably limited at the most to maybe a 50 million gallon a year ethanol plant if you have feedstock that's high in cellulose. And so that really, again, is the other thing, because you have cellulose and hemicellulose content, but then you have lignin, and many of these crops have a very high lignin content and a lower cellulose content, and the cellulose is where you get the sugars from. So it varies on field by field, but I think a big plant is going to be 50, 55 million gallons a year.
We're talking this afternoon with the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol about cellulosic ethanol in the industry and its development. His name is Arnie Klon. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
It's National Peaches and Cream Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1834, Cyrus McCormick received a patent for the first practical mechanical reaper. He originally demonstrated the machine in 1831 at a public trial in a field near Walnut Grove, Virginia. The field's owner called a halt to the demonstration, fearing the machine would rattle off the heads of his wheat. The demonstration then moved to a nearby field where it cut 6.5 acres of wheat in just half a day. In 1862, Charles Ellet Jr. died, an American engineer. He built the first wire cable suspension bridge in America. In 1893, the first Ferris wheel opened at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Invented by George Washington Ferris, it had 36 cars and carried 60 passengers 264 feet high. Its 45-foot axle was the largest single piece of forged steel at the time in the world. In 1898, Donald Peaty was born, an American botanist, naturalist, and author. He started his career in USDA's Office of Foreign Seed and Plant Introduction. In 1916, Joseph Bamford was born, an English inventor and industrialist. He is credited with the widespread application of hydraulic technology in construction and agricultural equipment. And in 1933, a barge loaded with grain arrived in New Orleans to complete the first Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico barge trip. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Arnie Klon. He's the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol. You can visit them online if you'd like. I believe the address is bluefireethanol.com. Correct me if that's wrong, Mr. Klon. And when we left you last, we had gotten to the point where you suggested that the proper sizing or the largest size of a production facility might be about 50 million gallons. That's much smaller than a corn-based ethanol. 50 is kind of a common number, 50 miles for the collection point for all of the stover, whether that's a plant that's grown directly for use or whether it's collected from some other place. Does this make cellulosic ethanol a niche market or a smaller market than corn-based ethanol by default, or does it just mean in the future you think there will be far more cellulosic ethanol plants distributed across the country?
Well, I think it's going to be, frankly, the factor that's going to be limiting the growth of the marketplace will be really the availability of feedstock. You'll have a lot more plants of the cellulosic type of plants than you do in the corn-based plants to get to the same volume that corn is producing. And, of course, under a renewable fuel standard that was passed back in 2008 and then 2009 again, you know, that's a 16 billion gallon a year designated marketplace by 2022 for cellulosic. Of course, corn is capped at 15 billion gallons a year for a total of 31 billion gallons a year of ethanol coming into the marketplace here in the United States domestically by 2022. So the cellulosic market in terms of a designated market is out there, you know, and that target is at 16 billion gallons a year. But you're going to see, to be able to achieve that 16 billion gallons a year, you're going to have double to triple the number of ethanol plants you have today. You know, just on a comparison basis, because again, unless you have a methodology for getting a higher unit density of feedstock, okay, and that's where the purpose-grown energy crops come in, because in fact, they have a lot more cellulose and hemicellulose entrained in the plant than say you would get from utilizing an agricultural residue type of thing. But you're still going to be limited, really, in the gathering and collection. I mean, that's really the bottleneck in the cellulosic plants. Now, for some farmers that, you know, we have talked to, they see, you know, the opportunity here because it really does add to the farmer's bottom line to be able to harvest that residue out of the field, to be able to put it in a position where it can be then utilized by the cellulosic plant. And so I think over time, as the infrastructure starts getting built, because bear in mind what we're talking about here for cellulosic ethanol is something that does not have a feedstock infrastructure that exists other than in experimental stage right at the moment. And I think once the people that really know how to handle this material, and by the way, that's the farmers, once they figure out what's a cost-efficient way of doing it, you might be able to build slightly larger plants. But again, it's just this energy density issue in the collection that really is going to limit the size of the plant.
If you had your choice, what would be the feedstock?
That's a very good question. Right now, you know, we've tested a lot of feedstocks. I think the optimum business model, okay, is sugarcane. And the reason why I say that is if you look at sugarcane itself and don't use conventional harvesting, but, where they burn the cane fields and then harvest the billets, but rather harvest the whole plant, bring that into the processing facility, and then, you would have basically the processing of the billet of the conventional methodology for recovering the sugars from the billet of cane. And then the residues that would be left over, which would be the leaves, the tops, the bagasse, after they've squeezed the sugar out of it, and then take that and process that into, or remove the sugars from all of that biomass material, you would just about triple the production of ethanol out of a conventional cane-based facility. So, we see that as kind of the optimum. The next optimum probably is again, if you come up with a different harvesting processing technique for corn, where, again, instead of just harvesting, the heads of the corn, is you harvest the whole plant and then separate it out in your factory, where what goes where, because the corn cob, everything in the plant can then be processed into producing that ethanol. And I don't know the exact number of the sugar content in terms of the stalk and what the ear would have in terms of the cob and that, but it would be at least double what you're getting out of a conventional corn-based ethanol plant.
Mr. Klon, thank you so much for joining us today. Any final word on Blue Fire and the experience that you've had?
Well, I think we should be excited as Americans because we have a technology that doesn't rely on foreign imports to meet our energy needs in this country. And I think the farmers working together, we see this as a partnership throughout the United States in which we can produce a whole new energy source. And by the way, we're focusing on ethanol today. But in fact, we can produce, we're working with a company called Solazyme, where we're producing biodiesel and biojet fuels. And there's other companies out there where you can not only from the corn produce the ethanol, but you can produce what's necessary to run the tractors, to run the jet engines that fly on the wings of airplanes and even do power generation today. I mean, we have something here that we can fundamentally change the econometric model of this country, and that's to go away from petroleum and go to a carbohydrate econometric model. So we should all be excited, and we should all be working together to try to make this happen.
Arne Klon is the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol at bluefireethanol.com. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.